if someone was violated by being exposed to pornographic content as a child, did they ever have a choice? The answer is no, because a minor doesn't have a choice. They can't have informed consent by viewing pornographic material and then becoming aroused and perhaps masturbating to it. That's not consent when it's happening to a child. Hi, welcome back to another episode of The Mindful Space. Today we have Dr. Julie, and our topic is going to be pornography. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thank you for coming. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Thank you. So we're going to dig right in, and I'm going to ask you, what would be the definition of porn addiction?
Okay. So I get asked that question all the time, and so I have to always push back and say pornography addiction isn't an official title. Okay. What we use in the field is problematic pornography use, and the reason for that is because addiction, the word addiction, comes with very specific markers of what would classify as an addiction, such as withdrawal symptoms paired with some very specific fatalities of life quality indicators that pornography addiction or problematic pornography use would not qualify under. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of debate in the field, but generally everyone accepts PPU or self-perceived problematic pornography use. And so that's the definition that we use.
Okay. So we should not use pornography addiction.
We should not use pornography addiction. And I'll get more into that later.
Yeah.
But the term itself has had some pretty devastating implications for the types of treatment that people receive.
Got it. Now, what are some of the symptoms? How do you know if you're going through this?
Okay. So the DSM, which is America's version of a diagnostic manual, doesn't actually recognize PPU in their manual or sexual compulsivity, but the international classification manual does under sexual compulsivity. And they have a very specific definition that has to do with like high frequency of use of pornography and inability to stop despite persistent efforts, along with specific calamities from interpersonal to interpersonal relationships. But within our company at the Steadfast Institute, we simply say that the definition would be someone that's trying to stop using and is unable to do so.
Okay. Is there a healthy amount of pornography? Is healthy not seeing pornography at all? Is there a range?
Yeah, so that's super subjective, right? So a lot of people could argue that small quantities could be healthy because maybe initially it might spur conversations between couples. Okay. Where they usually wouldn't have been comfortable talking about different sexual components, and it might enhance their sex life in some way. And so people get really excited that maybe there's like some healthy doses of use. At the Steadfast Institute, we would say in general, it's not really healthy. Because our sexuality is a really powerful part of who we are. It's a really powerful way of connecting with another person and connecting with ourselves. And we want that to be a very organic and authentic process. We don't want it to be influenced by outside sources that are not really interested in our sexual health or our ability to connect in relationships.
Yeah. And I completely agree, especially with the connection part. Yeah. Now, what can tell me, why is porn so addictive? That's a question I really want to know. Is there
pornography addiction isn't currently recognized as an actual addiction. And so when we talk about addiction, we would look for very specific pieces that would make someone addicted, right? And when it comes to problematic pornography use, we're looking at something pretty different. But when I say that, I don't want to undermine anyone's experience that it's as powerful as an addiction, because I really want to make sure people understand we honor that they feel that way. Yeah. And, you know, there's some researchers and clinicians on the other side of this that would completely dismantle the argument altogether, mm-hmm. which minimizes and undermines how people are really experiencing the issue. And we never want to do that.
Of course.
We more want to reframe the conversation so that people get the appropriate help. Don't unnecessarily label themselves in a way that would make them identify as an addict. So they get the right treatment and really conceptualize the issue, because it also has really negative implications for relationship. If the partner is perceiving it as an addiction when in reality isn't, mm-hmm. they might have a more hopeless view of the outcomes yeah. of the relationship as well. And so going back to your question, what makes it so problematic rather than addictive is a few different factors, right? One of the biggest factors is that most people begin viewing pornography in childhood. It's not like they begin viewing the minute they turn 18. Mm-hmm. In the studies that I've done, typically people have begun looking at pornography as early as 7 years old. Wow. You know, and at that okay. point, I think we can all generally agree that that's problematic in and of itself before mm-hmm. a problematic relationship even ensues. And so when you're looking at when pornography use began, and it's in childhood, you're looking at some of the same research questions really that you'd be looking at if anything else happened to a child in yeah. that period exactly. of life, whether it was their parents splitting, whether it was a negative sexual experience that happened to them, and how that could impact them in the future, right? And so we're looking at children basically that were basically sexually violated by this industry that's quite multifaceted, and it was never developed to help them. Yeah. And they're being exposed at such a young age, and that's a traumatic experience. And they develop these certain habits at first that become more reliances because certain chemicals are released when certain sexual triggers are made within our bodies, right? Okay. And so there's a chemical known as oxytocin that a lot of people are familiar with. Yes. And yes, it comes in varying doses when you smile, when you laugh, when you give a hug to someone. But when you become aroused and ejaculate, it's a much higher level of oxytocin that's released, which is the love hormone. And with that also comes the release of dopamine, which triggers this reward sensation in your body, right? And the serotonin levels that then increase also in that sense of well-being. And all of this happens when you're exposed to pornography very suddenly, quickly, and it's not long-lasting, right? Mm-hmm. And so when a child is exposed to pornography and all of the sudden gets this boost of all these yes. chemicals and this arousal and perhaps ejaculation or orgasm, mm-hmm. It creates a really powerful situation for those individuals mm-hmm. that from then on, because they found this easy way to trigger all of that, they might develop a reliance over time. So anytime they experience boredom, stress, any type of anxiety, loneliness, depression, they might all of a sudden trigger yeah. in their brain, okay, I have a way to get rid of that feeling for now. And they engage in something called experiential avoidance. And so they'll go to pornography and they'll experience that whole mixture of compounds and chemicals, and it'll give them a quick release of that. And so once someone in their youth starts developing that pattern, whether it's in childhood, adolescence, or so on, it's a really powerful reliance formation that they have developed.
Yeah.
And so that's why a lot of people will have difficulty stopping using, because it's then become an antidote to all these negative experiences, and it's novel, and it becomes a reliance.
What are some of the risk factors of having the PPU?
Right. So as I mentioned before, beginning viewing in childhood is definitely a risk factor, but it's not one that we're really talking about. It's mm-hmm. not really listed when we discuss PPU in sexual compulsivity in the international handbook. And it's actually something we're not really currently discussing when we go to academic conferences or publishing right now. And it's a big issue, and it's one that I'm trying to call attention to with a lot of my research, because we're looking at adults and we're not looking at their lifespan and mm-hmm. when they're exposed to pornography. But the study I just completed in a female-specific population mm-hmm. showed that 69% of women were exposed in childhood to pornography. And of that 69%, 60% went on to use pornography in adulthood.
Wow.
Right? And so if okay. we were to find a way to limit or reduce completely the prevalence of childhood exposure or onset of pornography use, we probably would be looking at much lower levels of PPU in adulthood as well. In addition to that, there's other risk factors, like if someone has autism spectrum disorder, whatever part of the spectrum they're on, whether they're really high functioning or lower functioning. I don't even like using the word lower functioning, but
yeah,
wherever they're at with that, they might have different severities with PPU, as well as someone with OCD. Another comorbid condition, and again, a chicken or the egg scenario, is ADHD. A lot of people with compulsive sexual behavior oftentimes are either diagnosed with ADHD after the onset of compulsive sexual behavior or before. And so we're really trying to figure out when that's happening and why it's comorbid. And so we do note that certain mental health impairments or intellectual impairments impact significantly what our sexual compulsivities might look like later on as well.
Yeah. Now, once you declare you have this, is there any effects on the brain per se, chemically or communication wise? Like what does it do to you mentally?
Yeah. So when we talked about earlier, the different chemicals that are released, right? The oxytocin, the dopamine, the serotonin, that inevitably alter certain brain functions, right? And when we develop that reliance on the use, it has some really significant relational impacts, right? So whether you're single or in a relationship, instead of causing us to connect in certain areas that we might authentically do so with ourselves or with a partner, it's causing us instead to turn this usually virtual platform for these certain releases, right?
Yeah.
And so we don't know exactly how that alters the brain. No one knows the exact processes quite yet, but what we are seeing is that it is having relational impacts. And what we just saw with the pandemic, right, was the pandemic of loneliness.
Yes.
And what we have with pornography is kind of this like interwoven, interrelational pandemic in and of itself, where people are isolating intimately into pornography use, especially if they're involved with PPU.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's some people that maybe haven't experienced as severe forms of PPU, and so they might get by. But those of us that are experiencing PPU to certain extents,
mm-hmm.
They're experiencing a lot of isolation. I just finished up a qualitative study with just women experiencing PPU. And I really like working with women specifically, because sometimes we'll look at men and we'll have this totally different perspective. We might label men and use words like they're disgusting, they're pigs, all things that are wrong mm-hmm. to do. But with women, we're less likely to use those words, mm-hmm. right? And I like working with the women because they're a little bit more talkative about their experiences, and they're a population that we judge a little less harshly when it comes to this issue. But my hope is that we can project some of that kindness to men as well when we discuss this issue. And what I've seen with women in some particular cases, they've described like the sexual deadening, where they've relied so much on pornography for arousal and orgasm that once they go with their actual partners, they're not able to become aroused or to orgasm unless they have some kind of pornographic stimuli,
okay.
which is really upsetting to the women
yeah.
because they're like, I want to connect with my spouse. Like, mm-hmm. I want this sexual experience to be between us. But now I either have to visualize those pornography scenes or I have to go watch porn beforehand. And it's very upsetting.
Yeah.
It's almost like a disabling effect on these women that have been involved in experiencing PPU.
Yeah. And that leads me actually to my next question, which, because I know you focus on women, the disabling effect of pornography on the female sexuality. Can we go a little deeper into that?
Yeah. So there's so much I could say about this. And, you know, if you go to the research side, we get very technical in research. We mm-hmm. can't like definitively say something unless we have this like abundance of evidence, right? While at the same time in research, we really value voices in qualitative research, right? Mm-hmm. But then we're not really always allowed to talk about the qualitative research in a really powerful way, which is kind of contradictory. But with some of the qualitative work I have done, what I found with the disabling effects of porn on women is, like I said before, this inability to orgasm or become aroused with just their partner or even themselves unless they engage in pornography.
Okay.
But then something else that's even more concerning is that I've seen women that I've worked with, and I always say I've worked with them. I don't say I study them. because I don't think we should look at research that way. Like, these are human beings. These are their experiences. Yeah. They belong to them. This is their stories. It's affecting mm-hmm. their life. And I don't come in as the researcher.
Yeah,
and
like, presume, you're my subject.
And presume to know more than they do. Yeah. I don't think that's ethical, especially when they're sharing their pains with me and trusting me with this information. And so as I work with them, I always reflect back with them. Like, am I hearing this right? Like, do you agree? If I were to make this statement in my research article, would you agree with it? And make sure that I'm getting it right. And two themes that have been really troubling both to me and the women I've worked with are really wonderful women that have relationships or maybe are single that are perceived by society. You know, sometimes they're in religious environments, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're really high achieving and sometimes they're not, whatever the case may be. But they all collectively, there's always this percentage. And I found this in my quantitative study and in my qualitative study that around 16% of the women report using illegal types of pornography, bestiality and child pornography.
Really?
And usually when we talk about bestiality or child pornography, we automatically think men, we think perverts, we think all these terrible, awful things. But these are like young women. These are daughters. These are sisters, they're mothers. And they're engaging in this. And they're telling me when I'm working with them, I don't want to be using this. It goes mm-hmm. completely against my values. But I'm so entrenched in pornography and I can't stop. And it's really troubling because one, in some cases, in a couple, and I'm not going to generalize this to the whole 16%, but some of them have actually engaged in behaviors with animals okay. and they hate themselves for it.
Really?
They're not relishing in this experience. They're not excited. They're not happy. They're not trying to justify it. They're saying like, I'm horrible. Fix me. Like, what's wrong with me? I don't want to be doing this.
Like in the moment, it's like the quick pleasure you're talking about, the right. releases of the hormones. And then afterwards, they shame themselves.
Right. Exactly. And like I said, these are women you're running into. These are women you would never think. They're like the sweet, quiet ones and that are in the church pew next to you that you think would like never do anything mm-hmm. like that. And so I have a heart for these women. And I have a heart for these experiences and how it might transfer over to the male side as well. We demonize people with these experiences and we silence them so they can't talk about how it's affecting their lives. And we have people on the other side glorifying pornography, acting like mm-hmm. it's not an issue at all.
Making
but meanwhile,
lots of money.
We suppress these voices,
yes.
these voices that want help and want to be heard. They're good people. And just because they're subjected to this experience, we're not giving them the help they need. And it all comes back to childhood. It comes back to, I started using then. I formed this reliance and I'm in so deep and I can't stop.
Okay. I mean, you're on a mission for sure. Now, how can someone who has the problematic pornography use diagnosis, or not through the DSM-5, but through the other manual, how can they start to treat it? Are there effective treatments? How can they start the journey of healing themselves?
Yeah, so this all goes back to that phrase, porn addiction, right? That term. That's created a lot of issues for us because we've labeled it porn addiction. Okay. And because we labeled it an addiction, most of the programs have developed models that are made for addiction. They've used models that are meant for drug and alcohol recovery, such as 12 steps.
Yes.
And it actually, in the long run, does more harm for individuals than good. At first, it might get them to stop, but it has some really problematic effects on your sexuality. And it doesn't actually help the behaviors to become better over time. And it definitely doesn't help them with their relationships with themselves or others. And so those programs are pretty rampant. Those are the main source that people think mm-hmm. they can turn to. We do have some programs that are developing now and coming out that are mindfulness-based programs, and those are definitely better, right? But my biggest concern with those programs is they're not multidimensional. They're not multidisciplinary. They're not addressing all the different components that I think are very important when we're dealing with this issue. And so at the Steadfast Institute, which is where I'm the director of research and development, we spent years creating a clinical acceptance and commitment therapy program influenced by ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. So you use this clinical mindfulness program. But in addition to that, we have evolutionary psychology weaved into it. We have John Gottman's principles of relational health weaved into it. We have EFT, which is emotional focused therapy, weaved into it, as well as other theoretical underpinnings that are specifically related to like males, females, and then the multidimensional elements of how you learn, right? And so that's mm-hmm. something that we don't always think about in clinical practice mm-hmm. is how people learn. And we take a very intellectual disability perspective on our programs where we make them integrative in such a way that if you have ADHD, if you have autism, if you have other disabilities, or if you're just the average person that has trouble with your attention span, it has a multisensory approach where the content is engaging and made for different paces, as well as having 24-hour mm-hmm. support in a professional available to you to walk you through the programs as well.
And what percentage do you find that all of this actually works? Like you've had successful cases.
Yeah. So the really interesting thing is that with acceptance and commitment therapy, just a plain ACT-based porn recovery program that doesn't even use all of our different foundations that are extremely helpful, has roughly an 80% recovery rate.
That's
and
amazing.
So ours, we've seen significantly more than that because of the different elements that we interweave into it.
That's great. How long is the program usually like length?
Yeah, so usually it's about 10 sessions and it depends on the pace. We recommend that people complete it within 12 weeks because the clinical research that has been done on ACT on porn recovery has shown that 10 to 12 weeks is an adequate amount of time mm-hmm. for someone to receive about an 80% recovery rate. And so we recommend that people don't do it shorter than that, but we also recommend people to go longer than that because you're not myelinating the information in the best way. But of course, we have different cases with people with different learning
conditions. Yeah, everybody's different.
Exactly.
So you can't really tailor it to one person.
And and recovery is going to look different for everyone,
yes.
right? We measure progress not by the fact that at the end of 12 weeks, you've completely stopped altogether. That would actually be really unhealthy and an unhealthy expectation. The majority of people that go through it might experience that, but our indicator for success is that you're able to lessen the frequency and intensity okay. of use over time. And exactly. so it's a weaning process. It mm-hmm. takes time. And people with more severe cases might take a year or more. But that's really not a long time in the grand scheme of things.
Exactly.
If you're actually healing through the process.
Correct. And better start late than never. So now, when we kind of mentioned this, you know, how do I know if I'm trying to use not to use the word addicted? So you already mentioned what are some of the signs to recognize yourself that you have an issue with pornography? When is it time to seek consultation?
Yeah. And that's going to be different for everyone too, right? Like if you're single and it's not seeming to impact you as much, you might wait a little longer. If you're in a marriage, you might want to get help faster. If your spouse finds out, you know, there's a lot of different, there's a lot of different markers for people that they choose. I would recommend that if someone's trying to stop between 6 to 12 months mm-hmm. and they're unsuccessful in their ability to stop, I would say get help.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so that's key term. If you want to stop, no matter if you see pornography 2 times a week or 1,000, the fact that you can't stop and it's interfering with your life, and
that is the stance that we take. Like I said, there's debate in the literature and in clinical practice on what frequencies would amount to problematic use, but that's so subjective.
Yeah,
and I think it's even if you're someone that doesn't view your use as problematic, try stopping.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens.
Exactly.
You know, a lot of people think it's problematic because they haven't diligently tried stopping or thought that maybe it was impacting them in some way. So give stopping a try, see what happens. And then if you're not able to do so, that should say, hey, something's wrong.
Yes. Like,
that's not okay. Because the way we perpetuate porn use in the media, not we, but others in portrayed in the media, is that it's harmless. It's a choice we make. Well, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, then try stopping. Let's mm-hmm. see what happens.
Yeah.
A lot of people won't be able to. And they'll say, oh, maybe for a month or two, I was able to stop. But are you able to successfully long-term not use it anymore?
Exactly. Now, going back to you saying that this starts from childhood and children are exposed to pornography. What do you think is the importance of having more sex education at school?
Yep. Okay, so this is a very big passion area of mine.
Yeah. It would only make sense.
Yeah. So right now, sex education is sparse. Sex education is taught maybe in high school, maybe once or twice a year, if you're lucky. It depends on what state you're in. Some states do abstinence-only sex education. Some states do comprehensive. Some states do HIV. And some states don't have any at all required. And so I can see a lot of the different sides of the argument for how we should do sex ed and why. But I think we as a public and community can agree we don't want our children looking at pornography, period. I think that's one thing we can all agree on. And so I think we need to develop early measures as early as elementary school, where we're holding assemblies just like we would do for tornado or fire warnings and say, hey, you know, there's this industry out there, the pornography industry. Yeah. There's a lot of amateur types of pornography. Let's learn about what happens if you come across it. Mm-hmm. You know, let's provide counselors to talk you through the trauma of viewing pornography as a child. Yeah. We don't have anything like that. No. We just don't want to talk about it because for adults, we didn't have the sex education. And so it's uncomfortable for us to talk about it. And so we're really just hurting our kids in the process.
Exactly.
And we need to at least begin, if we can't agree on how to teach any kind of sex education that early on, we need to at least agree that we'll have some kind of intervention strategies for a child exposed to pornography and teach them to recognize what pornography is early on. Yes. And that there's a comfortable space to learn to undo any of the damage that might have been caused.
Correct. And I think in general, sex education can even be more than that, you know, because then you go, you don't know anything. Nobody talks to you about it. Maybe your parents do, maybe not. And then they go and see pornography and they think that's real. Like, that's how it is. No, it's not. They end up finding out eventually. But I just think it portrays everything that's not really going to happen, you know, but I'm not going to get into details. Keep it PG-13.
You're exactly right. And, you know, I have a whole other conversation about that, but we're at the really early stages of talking about this. And we have a lot of studies coming out now. You know, in Florida, people don't want to talk about sex ed at all because there's so much controversy over the LGBT issues and so on. And these are all really important topics. These are things we need to talk about. But we need to start at a place where we all can agree and then build from there. And I totally agree. We should have more in-depth curriculum that's medically accurate, but we got to get parents on board too. And if it doesn't result in public legislation, at least parents that are concerned can begin having the conversation.
Exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, I'd rather have a professional person to talk to them medically, you know, with the right terms and the right concepts and me trying to explain.
Exactly. And there's really reasonable concerns that parents have on both sides about that too. You know, I feel very strongly about this topic, and with my own kids, I am very comfortable talking about all of this, but I would be worried about what professionals are being hired in schools, you know, because sometimes you have people being hired that have very different views that might come in and talk about pornography as being a positive thing. You just don't know how other people are going to talk about these very sensitive topics. And so parents do have reason to be concerned, but they should be even more concerned that their children are being exposed and that we're not talking.
For someone that may be wondering if they have this issue or that it's going through it, what would be your message, your advice?
My advice would be to take it seriously, to realize that you can get through this. It's going to be okay, but just to get the professional help you need so that it doesn't have impacts on you or your relationships that you might not be aware of. You know, the issues with pornography really come down to the sexual scripts or the sexual templates that we start developing because of this media influence, right? What we put in through our eyes and how it connects with our sexuality is really significant. You know, we worry about like the video games kids are playing and the violence. We worry about, you know, what we watch, if it's a waste of our time, but are we really worried about what we put in our eyes and how it's impacting the most important relationships in our life? Exactly. You know, and I would say to validate that there's going to be critics on the other side that say, don't worry about it. It's normal. They might say, oh, like, that's so prude to worry about it. But I think as a society, we're past that. It's not about being rude as a society. That was a long time ago. We're actually genuinely concerned because we have this relational pandemic, really, of loneliness, where people, even within marriage relationships, aren't able to sexually connect with their partners. The most important fundamental way of connecting with a partner that they would like to, because they're being impeded by these sexual scripts that have been created and made them unable to do so. Over 80% of women in America and likely internationally have been sexually assaulted at some point in their life. Yet we casually talk about pornography like it's having no effect on people. Whereas in clinical practice or in research, we have to do extensive training with the Institutional Review Board and be very delicate about providing interventions, even by using triggering words with people. Yet we're not having an emphasis on this majority population of women and how pornography could impact them. And we're talking so casually about it. And that also goes into, did they really have a choice? If someone was violated by being exposed to pornographic content as a child, did they ever have a choice? The answer is no, because a minor doesn't have a choice. They can't have informed consent by viewing pornographic material and then becoming aroused and perhaps masturbating to it. That's not consent when it's happening to a child. And so if a child's not consenting this content, they become reliant on this content as children. Do they even have a choice in adulthood?
Yeah.
We all often say, oh, these are consenting adults viewing pornography, but are they? Yeah. If they began becoming reliant in childhood, are they consenting adults in adulthood? Mm-hmm. Are they really? And that's where I say, okay, try stopping. You know, anyone can honestly ask themselves, have I been watching pornography that I'm actually not attracted to? And they wonder why. You know, like the story we talked about the women that are watching child pornography or bestiality pornography, and they're not actually attracted to it and they want to stop, but they can't. Where's the agency in that? Where's the consent? What's happening?
Yeah.
You know, and like I brought up earlier, men, it's not that someone can't get into a relationship because they're viewing porn, or that they can't keep a marriage together. The majority of the clients that we see are people that are unhappy, healthy relationships, that have successful jobs, that have a lot of friends, and they don't have the devastating consequences that addiction might have on someone's life. They're coming because they want to have an authentic sexual connection with their spouse or to obtain one with someone else. It's not a matter of whether you can be in a relationship. It's about the quality of the relationship. Sexuality is made so that we can perpetually evolve into how we're attracted with our spouse or a partner over time and with ourselves. And as I previously mentioned, any stage that your partner's in can become erotic and sexual to you, whether they lose a breast to breast cancer, whether they age, whether they're pregnant, whether they gain a lot of weight. If you continue the sexual communication, both physically and verbally, in your relationship. And like I said, that's why we see this really destructive pattern where even men and women begin viewing pornography that's not attractive to them. Men might become confused if they're attracted to someone of the opposite gender through pornography use, where they previously didn't identify as being gay, or other, you know, other appearances that they previously had no interest in, and perhaps become repulsed with themselves. And they're still able to be in a healthy, loving relationship with a partner. But how is the quality of the sexual connection? Do you really feel that same level of attraction and eroticism towards your partner if you're allowing yourself to constantly be exposed and confused by these outside forces? Probably not the same. You know, sexuality is there to strengthen bonds. And if you are disseminating it to all these other sources, are you able to really have that strength with your partner?
Exactly.
Probably not the same.
Probably not the same. Now, what about sex toys? Is that completely different than using pornography to arouse yourself when you're with your partner?
Yeah.
Toys are fine.
I would say sex toys are really different. You know, pornography is viewing specific types of content. made to arouse and be paired with masturbation. And you're having imagery. And then for women, women tend to use erotica, which is more like literature based. And I'm not talking 50 Shades of Grey. I'm talking like short erotic scripts that go from like 0 to 100 within a minute. And so whether it's audio porn, whether it's literature porn, whether it's a photo, video porn, hentai porn, and all the different mediums of porn that exist, the point is that you're engaging in an experience that's altering your sexual script, your love maps. And what a sexual script is, it comes from this theory in psychology and family and human development that says that our experiences around us form what we find sexually attractive and erotic, okay, right? And we're allowing that sexual script rather than to be informed from within or from someone we find because we connect with them on an emotional, intellectual, and other planes of attraction. We're allowing that sexual script to drive that rather than other more important core pieces that should be driving a relationship and its foundations. And we're disrupting the sexual script that's supposed to be informed after all of this happens, right? And so sex toys would not be in the same category at all. There's plenty of couples that can, you know, rid themselves of porn in their relationship and use sex toys, and it's not an issue.
It's not a threat.
But it's pornography. It's what's informing the sexual scripts that's disrupting the sexual attraction template that becomes problematic.
Got it. Well, I want to say thank you. I love the conversation. I know I definitely learned a lot. I hope our listeners did too. But yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for watching. Again, if you liked what you see, leave us a comment and don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you guys next week.